This is FSRN, the weekly edition. I'm Nell Abram. Coming up on this week's show, the scope and scale of DHS memos on immigration enforcement stun even seasoned immigrant and refugee advocates. Rollbacks of Obama-era policies continue. This week, the DOJ reversed Title IX protections for transgender youth and a plan to phase out federal use of private prisons. And in North Dakota, militarized police forcibly evicted the last remaining water protectors at the Ocheti Shakowin camp, arresting at least 45. Those stories and more on FSRN's Weekly Edition. The Department of Homeland Security issued a pair of memos this week spelling out how the agency intends to implement the executive orders on immigration that President Trump signed in his first week in office. The specifics and scope stunned even seasoned immigrant and refugee advocates. The memos call for hiring 15,000 new Immigration and Border Patrol agents, renewing efforts to have state and local police take on immigration enforcement duties, and expanding a procedure known as expedited removal, laying the groundwork for what could be mass deportations. And in what some say is particularly heartless, another change would end long-standing protections for individuals in or near sensitive locations, like hospitals, schools, and places of worship. FSRN's Hannah Lee Myers has more from Denver.
Jeanette Vizguera, a mother of four who's lived in the U.S. for 20 years, acknowledges her situation is going to require both patience and resolve. She's been living inside the First Unitarian Church in Denver since last week, along with two other undocumented women. But Vizguera fears they might not be safe there for long.
Every day we start hearing that they're going to be implementing President Trump's executive orders. I ask myself, is he really going to send in special forces to evict me from this church? And I have to ask myself, are they going to really continue to break rules and regulations? And where is Congress? Are they going to weigh in on any of this?
For years, U.S. immigration officials have followed an informal code of conduct, specifically referenced in a 2011 ICE memo, that discourages the detention of immigrants at and around sensitive locations, such as schools, hospitals, and places of worship. But U.S. Department of Homeland Security memos released this week suggest a potential end to those and other long-standing guidelines. David Leopold, immigration attorney and former president of the American Immigration Lawyers Association, says the memos are a how-to guide for mass deportation.
What this purports to do is throw out the ability to go before an immigration judge in literally millions of cases and be subjected to fast-track deportation without any hearing, without any ability to contest evidence, without any ability to show that you're eligible for asylum.
The memos are the first official acknowledgement by DHS that ICE is no longer prioritizing the deportation of immigrants convicted of crimes over individuals whose only offense is unauthorized presence in the country. Reverend Mike Moran is the pastor at Denver's First Unitarian Church, and he says religious institutions have a responsibility to protect immigrants like Vizguera and offer sanctuary to undocumented individuals at risk of separation from their families.
We are a church, we are a community of faith, we are an institution built around and dedicated to religious principles. We must not confuse what is moral with what is merely legal.
Cities, churches, and other locations that join the sanctuary movement refuse to use their own resources to aid federal authorities in deportation efforts. The Trump administration has vowed to defund sanctuary cities, but that didn't stop Boulder City Council from voting to become one in early January.
Aye.
Morzell?
Aye.
The motion passes unanimously.
Yeah.
Sanctuary city opponents like Jessica Vaughn from the Center for Immigration Studies say failure to support federal deportation efforts harms the U.S. economy, public safety, and violates the law.
U.S. Code 1324, which says that no one may harbor illegal aliens or shield them from detection by federal authorities. So any place that has a sanctuary policy that goes against these laws is not only putting the people of its community at risk, but they are putting themselves at risk for consequences from the federal government.
But sanctuary city leaders like Mayor Michael Hancock of Denver say they're willing to risk losing millions in federal funding to protect their immigrant population.
And I will not be bullied by Washington because they have failed to act. If being a sanctuary city means that we value taking care of one another and welcoming refugees and immigrants, then I welcome the title. If being a sanctuary city means families and young dreamers live with hope and not fear, then Washington can label us whatever they want.
From inside the First Unitarian Church in Denver, Jeanette Vizguera expresses her gratitude to religious and city leadership offering sanctuary to the undocumented and accepting the risks.
This is a time to unite, to come together, and to fight hatred with love. It is not a time to give in.
The DHS memos worry advocates that immigration agents will no longer regard churches, hospitals, and schools as no-go zones. And the arrest of six men leaving a hypothermia shelter at the Rising Hope Mission Church in Alexandria, Virginia, suggests that may already be the case. Hanley Myers, FSRN, Denver.
The Trump administration maintained its rapid-fire pace of rolling back Obama-era policies this week. Thursday, Attorney General Jeff Sessions revoked a Justice Department directive to reduce and eventually end the government's use of private prisons. The reversal comes as ramped-up immigration enforcement actions are likely to dramatically increase the number of detainees in federal custody. And with racial profiling that leads to a disproportionate incarceration rate for African Americans, also true for Black immigrants, their detention and deportation rates could go even higher under the new framework. Lena Nozizwe has more.
Immigrants make up almost 10% of the Black population living in the United States, according to the Black Alliance for Just Immigration, or BAJI. Most of them are from Africa and the Caribbean. And in the New York City, Newark, Jersey City area alone, almost one-third of the Black population is foreign-born. Mauricio Noronha, a staff attorney at the Harlem-based African Services Committee, says the new immigration policies impact the community he serves in different ways.
Some of our clients, for example, come from the countries listed on the travel ban currently being litigated. These differences have caused actual barriers in our clients' paths to becoming permanent residents in the U.S.
Noronha adds that more aggressive enforcement by ICE worries Black immigrants who, like African Americans, are subjected to disproportionately high rates of stops, searches, and arrests by police.
We have gotten a lot of calls, emails, visits from worried community members who are undocumented. They're concerned about whether they will be picked up and detained. We have even gotten calls from permanent residents and U.S. citizens with their own sets of concerns. Now, these fears don't necessarily reflect the reality of what's going on, at least for now, but they're real to the extent that they're causing actual harm to the quality of life.
Ramped up enforcement targets undocumented immigrants in particular, but Trump's executive orders were written so broadly that even visa holders charged with a criminal offense can be deported regardless of a conviction. As is, legal residents can be stripped of their visas for nonviolent offenses.
For example, we have many clients who have pled guilty to disorderly conduct charges for the simple reason they were selling food on the street without a license. And now these people will be considered dangerous and unworthy, and they will be targeted for removal. ICE is now saying that they will focus their efforts, that they will spend more money and resources on going after people like that now.
Many immigrant rights groups, including the African Services Committee and BAJI, have kicked into high gear in response to the policy shifts with advocacy efforts, outreach, and Know Your Rights workshops.
One of the online questions we got is from a volunteer woman from Dilley, Texas.
While most Black immigrants do speak English as a first or fluent second language, it is not the mother tongue of what is believed to be the largest group of Black immigrants in detention by nationality, Haitians. During a teleconference town hall meeting hosted by BAJI on President's Day, a caller said the need for Creole translators is acute.
She's saying I just came back from Family Detention Center in Dilley, Texas, and we presently have a lot of Haitian women and children there. The CARA project desperately needs Creole speakers to help represent clients.
A wave of Haitian nationals came to the U.S. last year seeking to qualify for an Obama-era family reunification program. Many are made to wait in detention centers pending the outcome of their petitions. Baji Programs Manager Carl Liskum told town hall participants that conditions for detainees are unnecessarily harsh.
What folks should know is that immigrant detention is not supposed to, you know, is not supposed to be punitive per se. Ideally and under law, immigrant detention is civil detention, not criminal detention. That being said, about 90% of detention, well, all detention centers are effectively prisons. One is under, you know, one is being monitored by officers 24/7. Officers direct, you know, what one does throughout the day at any given time. There's limited access to, you know, the outdoors. And to recreational activities.
The Trump administration plans to expand its already extensive capacity for immigrant detention. Thursday, the Justice Department reversed a directive aimed at reducing the federal government's dependence on for-profit prisons. Private prison company stocks, already soaring since Donald Trump's election, shot up after the announcement. As with the border wall, it's up to Congress to decide on funding. When it comes to the human costs, immigration rights advocates say non-citizens are already paying a high price. Lena Nozizwe, FSRN.
U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson and Homeland Security Chief John Kelly traveled to Mexico City this week for 2 days of meetings with high-level counterparts. The visit came on the heels of the immigration plans that will undoubtedly affect the large population of Mexicans living in the United States. Mexico flat out rejected one measure in the memos that calls for the country to accept non-Mexican deportees. The Trump administration is widely unpopular south of the border, but many Mexicans are also wary of their own government's ability to handle a deepening diplomatic crisis with their northern neighbor. Clayton Kahn has more from the Mexican capital.
Just weeks into the Trump administration, U.S.-Mexico relations are at their lowest point in generations. Trump's broad deportation plan, the ongoing dispute over an expanded border wall, and the unilateral intent to pull out of regional trade agreements have prompted a diplomatic crisis that Mexico's president, Enrique Peña Nieto, desperately seeks to resolve. In recent days, Peña Nieto has been driving home a message of national unity to rally support.
Hemos todos replicado esta convocatoria a la unidad nacional.
We have all responded to this call for national unity, acting on a common front, acting with great solidarity in defense of ourselves, in defense of the values that have identified us and that give us a sense of unity and belonging and pride of being Mexican. We must act firmly and decisively. We must act with sights set high, with serenity and prudence, but always keeping in mind and clear that first and foremost are the interests of the nation.
But many skeptics of Peña Nieto's administration question just how the president plans to defend national interests. Mexico's economy depends both on trade with the United States and on remittances sent back by the millions of Mexican nationals living north of the border. Those fiscal pillars now seem increasingly shaky, with Trump vowing to deport millions of undocumented immigrants and ringing a death knell for the North American Free Trade Agreement. Mexican border cities are bracing to receive unprecedented numbers of deported Mexicans. But investigative journalist and analyst Genaro Villamil says the Mexican government has no concrete plan to handle the crisis.
No hay una política clara.
There is no clear, forceful policy, no multifaceted strategy to defend migrants in the United States, taking advantage of the consular network in the first place, because many consular workers have already been fired. They stopped contracting lawyers. The consular network in the United States during the Peña government has focused more on commercial business relations and not on the defense of Mexicans.
And Bia Mil argues that it is precisely the jeopardized commercial treaties between the U.S. and Mexico above migrants' rights that has Peña Nieto's government most concerned.
La suspensión del Tratado de Libre Comercio es lo que ha puesto nervioso al gobierno mexicano.
The suspension of the free trade agreement is what has the Mexican government nervous, because all the expectations and deals of the business sector linked to the Peña Nieto government were designed in function of the continuity of the free trade agreement. The 11 structural reforms of Peña Nieto, especially the energy, telecommunications, and financial reforms, were linked to the continuity of the free trade treaty and the approval of the TPP agreement. And now that all this is moved, they are without a roadmap.
Earlier this month, thousands of Mexicans took to the streets in more than 20 cities to reject Trump's policies. The demonstrations were organized by more than 80 organizations, and although touted to be nonpartisan, they were promoted by some high-profile members of Mexico's business and political class. Bernardo Sepulveda, a member of the ruling PRI party and Mexico's top diplomat of the 1980s, argued that the street demonstrations displayed national unity.
Well, there has to be a political response, and one political response is what we are seeing right now, as I said before, by the Mexican community as a whole, rejecting Trump's policy. From the diplomatic point of view, the Mexican government is already undertaking a series of measures through the president himself, the Minister of Foreign Relations, the Minister of Trade. All of them are starting negotiations, a dialogue with the U.S. authorities.
Yet many viewed the protests as a cynical attempt by the ruling party to scrape together political capital. After nearly 5 years of corruption scandals, persistent levels of violence, economic woes, and a series of highly unpopular structural reforms, Peña Nieto has the lowest approval rating since polling agencies began measuring public opinion of Mexican presidents. Manuel Ceballos is a social activist.
El PRI está tratando de cooptar y de jalar agua para su molino.
The PRI is trying to co-opt and pull the water through its own mill, given that the popularity of Peña Nieto is very low, the lowest in the history of any other president of this country. And so they want to co-opt. They want to take advantage of the people's discontent. They want to do this while calling for national unity. But we say no to Peña Nieto or with political parties. Rather, we stand with civil society. There hasn't been a political leader in this country, whether it be from the right or the left, that has had the claws to stop Trump.
But as Mexico moves closer to its 2018 presidential election, some opposition party leaders are looking to capitalize off of the bilateral rift and show Mexican voters that they do have options. Yet in the short term, many Mexicans want to at least see evidence of a working plan beyond just appealing to voters. Clayton Kahn, FSRN, Mexico City.
You're listening to FSRN, Free Speech, Radio News, independent, non-commercial media. To find out how you can support FSRN, visit our website, fsrn.org.
In another reversal of Obama-era policy, the Trump administration rescinded federal protections for transgender students this week. In a joint letter to U.S. public school administrators, the Departments of Justice and Education said that counter to what they were told last May, schools are not required to provide trans youth with access to facilities that correspond with their gender identity under Title IX, the federal law that prevents sexual discrimination in education.
This is, on a practical level, going to cause real harm.
Ilana Turner, legal director of the Transgender Law Center, says for the past 15 years, the vast majority of courts have recognized that discrimination against transgender people is a form of sex discrimination because the two are inextricably linked. Refusing to provide trans youth access to facilities that align with their gender, she says, sends a stigmatizing message to the entire school community.
That really denies that student an equal education, just as a practical matter. So courts have found over and over again that to comply with the law, schools have to treat transgender boys like all other boys, and they have to treat transgender girls like all other girls.
The effects extend beyond bathrooms. 19-year-old Violet Martinez is vice president of the Trans Woman Empowerment Initiative in Albuquerque, New Mexico. The recent high school graduate explains how the discrimination she faced as a student affected her very access to education.
I never felt safe on campus, so I think it's not just having access to the restrooms on campus, but it's also reinforcing policies and guidelines against bullying. I noticed that it went far more over from just peers bullying me to actual administration, centering me and targeting me to as a form of discrimination, because I was missing school due to being bullied by my peers, which then got administration to contact me and bring me in their office and then threaten me with suspension and expulsion for missing class.
The DOJ-DOE letter specifically states that the federal government believes education policy in this context is best left to the states. Only 15 states have explicit laws on the books making clear that discrimination against trans students is illegal. On the other hand, according to the National Conference of State Legislatures, at least 14 states are currently considering measures to explicitly restrict access to multi-user restrooms based on biological sex. 8 of them are looking at school-specific measures. In North Dakota, a militarized police force cleared the main Dakota Access Pipeline protest camp near the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation Thursday. At least 45 people were arrested, including an 80-year-old Native grandmother with a decades-long history of Lakota activism. FSRN's Ro Packard has more.
Heavily armed police in riot gear, accompanied by military-style vehicles, moved into the Acheti Sakowin Resistance Camp mid-morning Thursday and began methodically clearing the area. Most water protectors voluntarily left the camp ahead of a Wednesday deadline. The Army Corps of Engineers issued an eviction notice earlier this month, citing a high potential for flooding in the low-lying area along the banks of the Cannonball River. But some chose to stand their ground and risk arrest on what they say is sovereign Native American territory under the 1868 Treaty of Fort Laramie. The independent media collective Unicorn Riot live-streamed the events.
So right now they're mostly still concentrated on the north end of camp. There's some sheriffs and police and probably National Guard in camp, and there's also significant forces still on 1806, like a large field force of people in riot gear. Also, most of the armored vehicles and Humvees still parked on 1806. A lot of them seem to be facing east into camp.
Since August, the camp has been the central location for opposition to the four-state, nearly $4 billion Dakota Access Pipeline. Indigenous opponents and their allies say routing the pipeline under the Missouri River near the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation threatens their water supply and violates their sovereignty. At its peak, thousands of people occupied the camp, including a large contingent of U.S. military veterans who traveled from across the country to provide logistical support and defend the protesters. Much of the camp emptied in December after the Army Corps of Engineers, under then-President Barack Obama, refused to grant an easement for the final leg of the pipeline and called for a comprehensive environmental impact statement. As winter set in and conditions became increasingly harsh, all but a stalwart few left. In his first week in office, President Trump issued an executive order expediting all approvals for the project. The Army Corps of Engineers granted the easement soon thereafter. Work restarted, and protesters began to return. As police carried out the eviction Thursday, observers stood on a nearby hill to document the actions. Acheti Sakowin is not the only protest encampment in the area, and it's unclear if law enforcement plans to take action against the others, including the original Sacred Stone Camp. For FSRN, I'm Ro Packard.
As protests and public dissent in the United States swell to historic levels, some state legislatures are considering draconian laws to criminalize certain types of demonstrations. This week, lawmakers in Minnesota and Arizona advance measures that critics say are crafted to curb First Amendment rights. Jared Goyette reports from Minneapolis.
Amid cries of shame, shame, a set of bills advanced in the Minnesota state legislature Wednesday that would increase penalties for protesters who block highways, mass transit systems, or access to an airport.
The vote is 10 ayes, 6 nay, and it is moved to the general register.
The legislation categorizes those acts of civil disobedience as gross misdemeanors, punishable by up to a year in jail and a $3,000 fine. They are part of a national trend of Republican-controlled legislatures taking up anti-protest bills since January, explained Spencer Woodman, a freelance journalist who has covered the issue for The Intercept. Spencer says it's no coincidence these measures are emerging just as protests against Trump administration policies sweep the country.
Now, I think the implications are pretty clear. It's these kind of new criminal penalties for protesting can have a very concrete effect in terms of people saying, you know what, I don't want to risk it. I'm not going to show up, and I'm not going to I'm not going to make my voice heard, because it could result in years of prison time or thousands of dollars in civil fines or both. I think the implication and the aim of these anti-protest laws are pretty clear, and that is to keep people home.
In Arizona, the state Senate passed a bill this week that goes even further, making participating in or organizing a protest that turns into a riot an offense that could lead to criminal racketeering charges. That means authorities could potentially seize protest organizers' assets and property. In North Dakota, the site of the Standing Rock protest, a bill that would have allowed drivers who injure or kill someone intentionally blocking traffic to escape liability, was defeated by the House of Representatives last week. Proposed measures to severely restrict demonstrations have recently failed in Virginia and Michigan. Other anti-protest bills are still pending across the country, notably in Missouri and Colorado. In most cases, the bill's authors have explicitly said that the measures are in response to specific demonstrations that block highways. In Minnesota, the Twin Cities were rocked by weeks of highway-blocking protests last summer, following the death of a young black man, Philando Castile, who was fatally shot by an officer during a traffic stop. That officer, Geronimo Yanez, is now facing second-degree manslaughter charges. Jason Soll, president of the Minneapolis NAACP, sees the bills in Minnesota as a direct response to those protests.
They haven't, appreciated our efforts to create equity, so of course they're going to keep responding the way they know how, and that's backlash and further oppression. I mean, with a Trump presidency, I'm not surprised that they're going to keep passing legislation that further oppresses.
Wednesday's hearing grew most emotional when John Thompson, a friend and former co-worker of Philando Castile, addressed one of the bill's authors, State Rep. Nick Zerwas.
So if you want us to stop protesting, sir, stop giving us a reason to protest, please. Because until then, you can charge me with a felony. I'll be in the streets protesting. You and white supremacy, sir.
The ACLU argues that many of these anti-protest bills violate the rights to free speech and peaceful protest guaranteed by the First Amendment. But anti-abortion bills passed in many of the same states show that GOP-dominated legislatures have been very effective at testing the boundaries of constitutional rights, or at least limiting them in practice until the Supreme Court intervenes. For FSRN, this is Jared Goyette in St. Paul.
And that does it for this week's program. Shannon Young provides editorial services from Oaxaca, Mexico. Roe Packard provides technical support from WTJU in Charlottesville, Virginia. Music in today's show is by Traffic in My Head via Jamendo.com. From Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abram. Thanks for listening.